Welcome back to the Life School Podcast from Morningstar Men's Ministries. This week we're continuing in our series on wisdom, and we're going to look at what we call opportunity and opportunity cost. The first thing that you're going to notice as you follow along with this week's material is that we're splitting the podcast into two separate recordings, a part A and a part B. This will give you the opportunity to listen in shorter bursts. Maybe use your drive time to listen to part A and then another day's drive time to listen to part B. And I hope that'll be a little bit easier for you to absorb the material. You know, there's no point in us offering something if it's not usable to you, and so we're always seeking ways to make something more beneficial and more helpful to you. Hope this will serve part of that purpose, and as always, we hope this is a blessing to you, and we look forward to catching up with you again next week. So just a couple of observations about what we're going to talk about. Some weeks, there's a very clear presentation, it's very linear, it's straightforward. Last week was one of those where I felt like everything that needed to be said was said pretty much, and it was said in a straightforward manner. This is very different this week. I'm going to throw out some ideas. I'll call them concepts. Concepts around which you might be able to build a framework for certain parts of the wisdom of your life. But it's up to you as to whether you do anything with it. So you might leave here feeling more confused than when you got here. So if you're partly asleep, that's good because you won't really feel anything different. So we're going to start off with just a collection of what seem like very disconnected, random ideas, and they might not make much sense until we get to the end. So just bear with it and look for connection. And everything that we're looking at this morning surrounds a single idea. What does God want me to do with my life? What's the big thing or the big things that God wants me to do with my life? Maybe it shouldn't surprise me, but it still does when I hear people ask that question. Not 20-year-olds either, or 25-year-olds. I expect 20-year-olds to still have those kinds of questions maybe, or be exploring that or curious about that. The remarkable thing is that I still hear that from people in their 40s and their 50s. And so I've actually come to the conclusion that none of us is ever, or most of us are not ever, thoroughly settled or convinced that we know specifically what God wants us to do. So just hold on to that idea. And the first thing that we're going to introduce, and it's related to that, is opportunity. Think of an opportunity that you have. Something that you aren't now doing, but you might do. Something that you've thought about doing, and you wish you could do. But you're still on the fence about it. And it could be ministry, it could be, I don't know, where you're going to live in the future, what you're going to do in the future, whatever it is. There is a potential opportunity. All right, so here's the first question about that opportunity. How far removed from your present reality is it? Is it merely a few steps away? Is it intimately connected to where you are now and just an advancement of the track you're on now? Or is it something so different that it would be a departure from what you're now doing? And now we're going to introduce the phrase opportunity, or the term opportunity cost. Anybody know what an opportunity cost is? It's frequently used in, we'll say, economics, but it should be used in all of life, frankly. So we've explored opportunity. We say, what are some of the things that you might have the chance to do in the future, or toying with doing, or feel maybe even a call to do? But then we have to introduce this term, opportunity cost. What is that?
What does the term mean?
Yeah.
Well, an opportunity. If you want to do, when you leave to go home, it's going to cost you something. You want to do something, it's going to cost you gas, time, you know, maybe even if there's something, a detour.
Okay. That's what most people would think. Surprisingly, that's not actually what the term means. What the term means is when two competing ideas are there for you, and you're considering, should I go to the left or should I go to the right? And you can't fuse the two together. You know, isn't that what we like to do? We like to take a little from column A, a little from column B, and it's like life should be a buffet because then we could get our way in every way. But it's not. And so an opportunity cost is when I am forced to choose between two mutually exclusive things, and I have to consider what I'm going to lose by going the way that I'm going. So in that sense, I stack up all of the benefits of the next most attractive option that I'm going to have to turn away from. And I have to subtract that from everything that's on the side that I choose to move toward. So for instance, if I were to choose, this is so far removed from most of our lives that we can explore it without any emotion. I've just graduated from college, and I have two pathways before me. I can choose to set out and hike throughout South America. I can live the life of a traveling nomad, and I can see the world, and I can enjoy myself for 2 or 3 years. I won't have a job. I'll be lucky if I know how to feed myself when I leave here, but it'll be a really fun trip. Or I could take my education that I've pursued for the last 6 or 8 years, and I can go and I can become a Wall Street broker. Well, I'll have a secure job. I'll be working in the field that I've studied for, and there'll certainly be financial opportunity. Now you see, the two of them are pretty much mutually exclusive. I really can't be a great Wall Street broker and at the same time be traveling throughout the Andes, right? On the other hand, I really can't be much of a traveler and be stuck in Manhattan.
Go hiking first.
Isn't that our temptation? Maybe I can get a good internet connection from time to time, and maybe I can do a little bit of that. Isn't that our temptation?
Or is that just what we've developed into?
Well, I think we try to do that, and there's nothing wrong with when we can hybridizing things. But okay. Since you had to be the devil's advocate here, and the devil was not wanted here, he could advocate for himself. Do I marry the girl from column A, or do I marry the girl from column B? Or do I stay single? Obviously, what we don't have in numbers here, we make up for in enthusiasm for the topic.
But what you can do is you can look at, okay, is he a better hiker or a better money broker? Which one of these develop more?
Okay.
That person, can you really give all of it to your hiking and enjoy it, or can you give all of it to your boardroom experience and be actually good at it, or are you always living in the Andes while you're in the boardroom?
Notice what Jim is doing, and he's doing a great job of it. He doesn't have to make the decision for himself, so it's easy for him to sit there and analytically evaluate things. But what does it feel like when you're the person making the decision and the decision is not about somebody else, but it's about you? What does it feel like then?
The emotions are on them. Yeah. And then it gets...
That's exactly it. What do I feel like doing? What do I feel like doing? I feel like one of the Andes is wandering around for a few years. Okay, who's going to pay for your kids' college? Who's going to pay for your beautiful home in the Hamptons? Who's going to pay for that stuff? Well, I don't know. Okay. There's, like you're saying, there is...
For every choice that we make, we're going to potentially experience gain, but we're going to potentially experience loss. And most of us are not at peace with that. John.
So I'm actually in the middle of this right now. I am in a secure job. I make decent money to support my family, sponsor kids, all the things that we've kind of gotten into over years. And I'm in a place where I work in my attic by myself. Almost no human interaction. I get emails and every once in a while I come up. I feel that...
You work in your attic?
I work in my house, yeah.
Okay.
Every day.
Well, just say you work in your house. When you say I work in my attic, it sounds so very depressing.
I'm just trying to get away from my family so it's not distracting me and all that. So I work in my house. So I have this feeling like I want to talk to people. I see all the broken people around me. People need help. I want to help more people. I find myself thinking about recent sermons that I've heard. I want to, talk about stuff that you talk about here with people, and I really can't do that much of my job. So I'm going to struggle, do I do ministry type work, or do I kind of shift? And, that cost of my safe, secure, my money, everything that I've kind of built my career, I can sacrifice that, but I don't know. not a prayer's the only thing, but I am actually going through that struggle right now. It's not so easy to just, you know, jump from one to another.
Go ahead.
But you don't have to go all in on another. You don't have to go all in. Do a little ministry work. Do a little community
that's work. That's what I'm
doing. Put yourself out there. So feel it out. You know what? You don't even know what direction ministry you want to go. All these people or those people. You can't do it all. Let me tell you, you can't do it all in ministry. There are limitations in your job. I'll tell you that. You can't be in the pulpit on Sunday, be here, go to the hospital. Everywhere at once. So what do you do? When you brought it up, I'm thinking, all right, well, what are you called to do? What are you called to do?
Well, like you said, you don't want to be sitting at Wall Street thinking about the Alps. I'm sitting on
Sunday, you want to go to the Alps.
Well, like you said, he's sitting in his attic thinking about human interaction. Like, I'm sitting here. But in my mind, how is this helping people? How is this glorifying God? How is this getting more people into the kingdom?
All right. So we have a real first person encounter with this right now. So, all right.
And what do you do? That's a hard decision.
Well, of course it is, which is why we're talking about this morning. All right. So we've introduced the concept. Remember, it's not my job to make anybody else's decision. I'm just trying to introduce some ideas. So what's our tendency when we do this? And we're going to look at two verses, because the second big principle for the morning, if the first was that most of us struggle with understanding or discerning where we should be, and we think that we should have clearer understanding about it. You see, I wouldn't be queasy or uneasy about finding my place in the world if somebody would once tell me it's really difficult and you may not clearly find your place in the world. But what we find is that there are people who tell us, yes, it's easy to discern God's will, it's easy to be in God's will, it's easy to do this, and you should know where you belong. And the second big idea for the morning is that I'll say it like this, where sometimes we are led to believe in life that there are clear choices between column A and column B, that what I'm discovering personally and what we're going to look at in Scripture this morning may imply that we live in a constant tension that is never completely resolved, and that it would be better for us to adjust our expectations to live in a tension, and that actually the tension is good for us because it keeps us alert. Remember what we talked about last week, if you were here last week, that tension that we try to avoid between two competing things is actually good for us because it does keep us alert. And the opposite of being alert is essentially to be complacent and indifferent. And you know there's a lot of dangerous things happen when we're complacent. So I don't know for sure that we ever arrive at that thoroughly settled place where I know I'm exactly where I need to be, doing exactly what I need to be doing, and that's it.
And I think that would be unique.
Which?
That feeling that, like, oh, well, I'm in God's will, and I know that I'm in God's will. Well, how do you know that? No, how do you know it? You can believe it. How do you know it? You personally sat down with him in the chair, and he said, hey, you're in my will.
So we'll introduce another part. And incidentally, we're still in the study of wisdom, although it doesn't sound like right now we're in the study of wisdom. It sounds like we're in the study of chaos and confusion. But isn't that part of the struggle for wisdom? So remember what we said so far, and I hope that someone here can fill in the blanks. When I need behavioral wisdom, I would turn where? I can turn to the Scriptures. But when I want long-term directional or destinational wisdom, where am I generally likely to find that? Anybody remember? In a community of friends. Friends that know me well, that I respect, that know life well, that if I want behavioral wisdom, I can turn to the Scriptures and it will tell me, do this, don't do that. But when I want directional wisdom, destinational wisdom, what is the destiny of my life? That I am better served by being in the company of a group, a small, closely knit group of people who know me well and I know them well, and we really love each other in the sense that we look out for each other's best interest. And we're willing to speak into each other's lives. So if you ever want to have destinational wisdom and you are not in a community, a close-knit community of three or four peers that can advise you, that know you well, could I suggest that maybe that's one of the areas that you need to start, because you'll never find the wisdom completely that you need apart from that. All right, let's look at these two scriptures which are often used, and they're right there on your page, so you don't need to turn anywhere. And they kind of illustrate, excuse me, this tension. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city and spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Well, you do not even know what will happen to you tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or do that. All right, now, apart from that select few people who, in almost everything they say God willing before almost everything. God willing, I'll see you in 5 minutes. And they just interject that in everything. But apart from them, there's a certain tension that's expressed here. Do you see it? Let's take a look at the next verse, because it captures it in sort of a different way, but the same way. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. And then he talks about, how do I understand that cause? Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000 men? And if he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. The same tensions exist there. Can anybody see it? Describe it?
In recovery, they're saying, for the foundation to hire me, I can go further in recovery. My foundation of accountability is wider, deeper. Because when I'm in trouble and I make that phone call, I'm relying on one person to be at home, pick up the phone, have the 20 or 30 minutes that's going to take to talk me down. I'm really cutting it too close to the edge. But what if I have to face 30 or 40 people that I can call? Maybe 20, maybe even 10. That I can call and seek wisdom, because I'm sitting in my attic and I want to start something, but I'm not sure if I should do that. But I'm only going to go to one guy. You might be doing the wrong thing. What if you ask 20 people? And eight of them said, well, that's not really your temperament. You know what I mean? Like, you're not really a people person, and you want to go be with people.
Okay, so you're looking at decision making through the friendship model that we just talked about a minute ago.
I'm just trying to bring it back in.
I want to look at this as exploring a different tension here, and here's the tension. All of Scripture calls on us to make good decisions in one breath, and yet in the next moment says, but you don't know what's going to happen to you in the next moment. Now, if you really look at those two, set them side by side on a shelf and stare at them, you could be confused. Well, how do I do this? Which is it calling on me to do? To live in total trust, expecting that God is going to guide my next step, because clearly I don't know what's happening in the next moment, or do I plan?
The problem with that is, it's not even confusion. You're not confused. You know exactly what each of those things is. You're paralyzed with fear, because you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring.
But yet, does the king, who's about to go to war, know what tomorrow is going to bring? No, he doesn't. Does the businessman who's going to go off to such and such a town and is planning on that, does he know what tomorrow is going to bring? No, he doesn't. And we have phrases, we have phrases that sort of describe this, that I should plan and pray at the same time, that I should plan as if I'm going to do something, but I should pray as if something else. We need to be comfortable in living with this tension. I'm going to plan to do things, and what is God calling on us to do? Look at what Jesus said. Don't even bother to follow me unless you've sat down and counted the cost and are willing to do that. Don't even bother. Just stay where you are until you have accepted the opportunity cost of following me. And if you're not at peace with that, stay put until you are. Scott.
I mean, same situation me and John is in. I mean, you give your life to Christ, there's a cost. You got to give up all your bad habits, all your bad connections, all your temptations, you know, and live the life that Jesus wants you to live. That's the cost of pursuing eternal life and having, you know, joy in your life. In a career sense, trying to advance economically and have more opportunity and more challenge in a job, I have the potential to move into another position. I don't truly understand what the position is going to entail for a workload, demand, frustration, new work. Certainly there would be a large economic decrease. But along with that, the opportunity cost is my happiness and my self directives at work are going to be eliminated. I can get this and give up my happiness and my satisfaction at work.
Do you know that for sure?
I don't know that for sure, but it seems like by the demands of the position and what people are talking about, the situation and the operations, it doesn't seem like an environment that allows me the latitude that I have now. I'll be more restricted as far as what I can do as far as decision making, what I can do as far as planning. My time scheduling will be changed and be more towards somebody else's.
You're not going to have as much control.
I won't have as much control. I won't have as much ability to be the decision maker. And that conflict, that opportunity cost there is a big gap that I have to fill in to say, is it really worth a couple extra dollars to give up the freedom that I have at work? Or do I stay where I am now and try and adjust my attitude to anybody that does anything for a long period of time? Yeah. Someone gets a little bit
stale.
Yeah, stale. They become, you know,
complacent. You get stagnant a little bit.
Stagnant. You start to find the negatives you've got. One of them is
fire. So let me introduce an additional question there. Can you stay where you are, knowing where you could go? And will you be respected the same where you are if you stay there? Or will your opportunity there actually shift once people know that you turned down an opportunity to do something else?
What?
I mean, I don't know your environment, but sometimes... And do you see all the unknowns here? Are you about to say something?
I don't want to say too much, because I'm talking tomorrow. The enemy within is worry. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, do not worry about what we're going to eat or drink or wear. And two things, he doesn't say don't be concerned about things, and he's not saying don't plan, because God's a planner, obviously. So there's a lot we can say, but I started to say, just interject easily, the will of God, and when we believe, now we get a track, we get a direction, doesn't mean it's going to be easy or easier. And sometimes we fall into that, well, the will of God's going to be easier.
And is corporate going to think that you're not a team player because you're not stepping up and taking the position that we thought you'd be great at? So now you're not being a team player. You're just sitting back and just holding on to what you have. We're paying you nicely already, and we'd really like you to step up, but you're not willing to do that. So how does corporate do that if you step up? Are all your coworkers now, in respect to your life, you've got to think, you traitor, you went up to the glass palace, and now you don't even come back and say hi anymore, that kind of thing. Which is nonsense, by the way.
All right.
But I was just going to say, one small thing to think, and we want, there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors, people that we could trust.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's be careful, because I kind of heard something, well, people said this. You can't discount a lot of that, what people say. That doesn't mean anything.
And the guys that are already in that position, that know you're good, I was listening to Alfie Beck talk about this, they're jealous.
Yeah.
The jealousy that you might actually come up and be better. I have a goal with this, because I've been doing what I've been for 30 years. And when that young kid comes in, he knows how to tune, and he's quick, he's faster than I am, his knees don't hurt, his hands don't hurt, he's quick, he's, you know what I mean? Like, I can do one of two things. I can be jealous, and every time he does something well, be like, yeah, well, you missed this, or you missed that, blah, 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 blah. All right, he said, hey, good job. Way to go. That was nice. I like where you did that. Hey, teach me that. I've been changing tires for 28 years.
All right, let me...
A young guy taught me how to actually do it faster. A young guy. Hey, you know what? All you do is flip that button the other direction, and you can save yourself 5 minutes. Hmm. You can always learn, if you're willing. Always.
So the final thing before we leave this, the tension between two different decisions. We always assume that we're in a situation that that's going to stay the same. See, we never ask ourselves the question, what if my present situation, the one that I think is secure, was to deteriorate tomorrow? What if my attic was to burn down tomorrow? Or the basement, or wherever. What if that wasn't there? Because we assume that what we have and what we know is always going to be there. And that is as unstable and unsure in this equation that James describes as the thing that I think might be risky out there.
God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Burn my attic down. Invested it with, I don't know, critters. The smartest guy I can find out.
And so... I don't know how to weed out the wisdom from the foolishness in what I hear from him every day. And I know there's good stuff. Actually, truthfully, can I just parenthetically insert this? I don't really understand half of what he said until I listen to this before I upload it. And then sometimes I think...
Because I feel like I understand him more and more.
So which is the course? Do I pursue incremental increase or do I make the bold leap? And I think sometimes we think it's safer or it's wiser to pursue incremental increase. But here's where Jim's wisdom and is fused to your search. What if I begin this step? So I'm going to tell you the first of a couple of stories. I don't know how many I'll get to tell you, but... So here's the first one. 12-year-old figure skater. She's on track to be in the Olympics. She's competing in a regional event that's going to qualify her, and everybody believes that she is going to qualify in that regional event, and she's going to advance to a national qualification process. She's 12 years old, and she's very good. She skates off the ice one day, and she tells her coach that she has a pain in her leg. The coach says, don't worry about it, it's probably just you twisted a muscle or something. Just relax, you've done well for the day, just walk it off, so to speak. Take a couple of days off, don't train hard for the next couple of days. We'll see what it looks like. So she follows the coach's advice, because after all, what else would she do? A couple of days later, she goes to skate. Not only is the pain still there, but the pain is seeming to get a little bit worse. And so ultimately, she tells her parents this. She doesn't want to tell them at first and have them worried and say, well, maybe you shouldn't do this, because she's got big aspirations. So she tells her parents, and then, well, what did the coach say? And, well, the coach said this, and it's like, okay, we'll give it a couple of days. And then finally the parents conclude that this needs some sort of attention. So they take their 12-year-old girl to the hospital to have her looked at, and it turns out that she's got some rare form of cancer that's in something in her leg. Specifics of them, I'm not really that sure. Well, anyway, devastating news that she gets only a few weeks later, that this is an untreatable form of cancer, and this is a real story, incidentally, and there's not much hope. There really is not much hope. She goes into school. She shares this with her teacher one day. And she's obviously emotionally distraught, and for some reason she believes that she can trust her teacher. The teacher, just like any one of us who knows people, the teacher goes to her church community sometime, and she shares this story. Maybe exactly like we do at the end of our thing, where please pray for this or that person. And in that church community is a human resources person who works for a Ritz-Carlton in Dearborn. The biggest dream that this girl has, that she says when she shares with her 8th grade teacher, is, you know, the thing that I'm going to miss most in life, and what would you assume that it would be? If you were a skater and you were on track to be in the Olympics, what would you think would be the thing that you would miss most if you died prematurely? Wouldn't that be it? Or standing? But guess what this young girl thinks that she will miss most? The chance to be part of her high school prom. It seems like a bizarre thing to you and I, maybe, but to her, that is the biggest thing in life that she will miss, and she tells this story to her 8th grade teacher. Remember, this teacher, also part of this fellowship, knows this other woman. And so the woman at the Ritz-Carlton decides, you know what? She might only be 12, or by this time 13, so there might not be a high school prom, but we could make a prom for her. And so one woman in HR at the Ritz-Carlton decides, I can make this happen, and she surrounds herself with people on her staff, other leaders in that local hotel. They pull out all the stops, and they have an incredible event for her. 60 or 70 friends, other skaters. They even find the perfect date for her for the evening, just so that she has someone to dance with for the evening and all that. And she is so close to being laid up by this time that she says at 10:30 the prom has to end because she has to wake up early the next morning to go in for additional cancer treatments. So can you feel the tension there? The happiest day of my life, and the next day I'm going to go back to the hospital and confront the thing which I'm most grieved about and which is ultimately going to take my life. How much of a difference do you think that made to that girl? It was huge, wasn't it? And yet, what was the sacrifice that was ultimately necessary? It wasn't a lot. It was just being the right person at the right place with a little bit of awareness and then having the courage to say, I think we could do something different in this game. Now, how many times do you and I pass opportunities every month? I'm not going to say every day. That's too daunting. We could drive ourselves crazy. Do you pass an opportunity a month in which you could make a big difference in another human's life? Simply by taking the connections that you already have and bringing them together and doing something. And I suspect we could do that. Jim.
You take every opportunity to whine and complain, and I'll just say complain and bitch about something. But yet, to take the opportunity to do a kindness for somebody, oh, I'm too busy, or oh, I'm on my way to work, or oh, I got all this stuff to do. Why? We never miss an opportunity to complain about work, co-workers, the guy at the top, what he's doing, what they're doing, or my life.
And wouldn't it have been, as I tell you that story now, and there's very limited details there, I realize, but do you think it would have been easy to justify not doing that? Well, we can't use company resources, we can't involve the staff to do this or that, we certainly can't use this room because we wouldn't have corporate approval, or we couldn't this, or we couldn't that. Would it have been easy to find reasons not to do something? Of course it would. What is the attitude, the general outlook of our lives? Are we opportunity driven or not? Or are we opportunity cost concerned? Is it possible for each of us? And right now, I don't want to be standing. Frankly, I'd like to be sitting because I'm not like here as your guide because I have already mastered all this, believe me. I am sometimes the most selfish jerk in the world. Well, maybe the second most. I know some pretty selfish people, so I'm not sure where I rank, but it could be near the top. So I don't feel qualified as your guide to take you places that you have never been, but I surely have scaled those peaks. Instead, I feel like I'm just a schmuck, just like you, stuck down in the mud, but I might have stuck my head up once and seen something. Really, that's it. How many times do we have the chance, like Jim said, to do something, but we complain about it? And here's my question. Why would God give us more opportunities if we don't take advantage of the ones we have? And I don't mean that in a preachy sense, because we've all heard that when somebody stood up on a Sunday morning or you turned on the radio and somebody made... They jacked up your guilt index by about 1,000 points when they said it, and I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to think of, would you tell your child to go clean the attic if they hadn't come? I don't know why the word attic is stuck in my mind now, but would you tell your child to go clean the garage if they couldn't even take the initiative to clean their room? Would you give your child something great to do if they didn't seem committed to doing something small that was right there in front of them? So why do we look for God to tell us? And again, I'm right down here with everybody else. I am not an inch above anybody else.
There's a difference between what you're talking about. I think I'll say, in the public world, in the public arena, you can do what you do. You do. You're qualified to do the job that they want you to do. It's not like you guys are being asked to do some crazy thing. Like, well, you're going to go be a cliff diver somewhere. I'm not. That's ridiculous. But for somebody like me, then here's where I'm going with that. They wanted me to be a service manager. I said, I can't manage. I don't manage. I first of all, I'm going to use this computer. I'll be the best shop foreman you ever have. I'm not afraid to make decisions. I'm not afraid to lead. I'll be the best shop foreman you've ever had. But I don't know that I'll be able to manage. I hate paperwork. I don't like talking about money. I'm more apt to give it away than to have to pay for. I would rather have you be mad at me for being honest than for lying to you. Like, there are things that kind of disqualify me from that, too. So, am I going to be the best shop foreman or a mediocre service manager?
Okay. The one thing I like about Jim is when he gets on a roll, it gives me plenty of time to plan for the next thing. I can set up the next paper, get the board ready, do all that stuff. But he makes some good points. No, what I just said doesn't directly relate to your dilemma or to your dilemma. But then it sort of does, because there are times when we can go a little way in the direction. So there aren't always all or nothing propositions. All right, so I put this little thing it's on the back of your first sheet. So the other week we looked at a wisdom supply chain. Today we're going to look at what I'm going to call an opportunity supply chain. And I haven't yet committed this to memory. And I'll tell you in a little while where this came from and why I put this together. So the first thing is presence. And presence simply means, are you there? Are you in something? Are you at work? Are you at home? Are you in the community? Because it's easier to sense opportunity when you're around where the opportunity is. And the next one, obviously related to that then, is awareness. And remember, this is very linear. When I'm in something, I have the possibility of noticing something. So the first question then, to get from here to there, is what are the things in your present life that you're not noticing? If you're asking God for direction in life, if you're asking God for purpose in life, what are the things where you are right now that you're not noticing where you could do something? Are there clues? Is there anything in where you are, if you look around, that can help you to understand or discern something? Now, you might know many definitions of empathy, but let's just say that it is the ability to connect and understand with something. So when I look at what I hear Scott tell me a story. So first off, Scott has shared something with me. Scott and I are together. Because Scott and I are together in the same room with all of you, and Scott tells me a story, I can be aware of his dilemma. If I wasn't in the room, I couldn't be aware of his dilemma. So I'm exposed to it, but do I feel it? Or is it just an interesting story? In other words, do I understand the tension? Because I can be aware of Scott's story, and I can ask him about it when I see him on Sunday. Hey, how's that job search going? Or how's that career move going? Or whatever. But I might not give a rip about it. How many people whose dilemmas are you aware of do you not feel for? Versus the ones that you genuinely get. And as we understand more about the mind, we understand that there are actually centers in the brain where even if I have not done something myself, I can project and start to feel the pain that others feel. I can feel the angst that they feel. I can feel the fear that they feel. Are you feeling that for anything? And this is where it gets uncomfortable. Does it make me want to do something? Now, what would I do about Scott's thing? I might not be able to do anything. The one thing I might be able to do is say, Scott, I want you to know if you would like a friend to interact with and discuss, I'd gladly make myself available as many times as you need or as often, whenever, if you want to get together. That might be all I can do for that. There's certain other things where it would be. See, that's an easy risk, that one right there. some of the risks are big, and I'm going to tell you a story in a minute that's kind of interesting. Has nothing to do, it's not even going to sound like a spiritual story. But the inspiration is powerful. Do I feel a personal connection to this at this point? Am I inspired to act? Do I get involved? And do I still feel the connection once I get involved? So let's say that Scott and I connect. At the end of the first evening, I realize I don't feel any passion anymore for this. I don't feel that connection, or do I? Because if I do, it's going to compel me to go to the final step, which is full-out interaction and commitment. I'm going to jump ahead to the last page. I think it's the last page of the notes here. I don't think there's a person here who hasn't heard the idea that we need to be passionate about things. I want to look at a tension that exists between two words that we think are connected, but I think they're very different. And the words are like and love. And we tend to think of like and love as just being sort of on that same sliding scale. You know, that I move from, well, I like something to I really love it. So what do you think? Does that seem right? I like this girl. I love this girl. I like this job. I start to love this job. Not. Are they simply along the same continuum? Like to love. What if they're two completely different ways to look at the world? What if they're not this, but instead they're on completely different scales? What if like has to do with my preferences and biases? It's how I see the world and want the world to be for me. My liking you says more about me than it does about you. My liking you tells the world that I have certain tastes and you happen to fill my tastes. What does love say? And now we're going to say biblical love. What does biblical love say? Love says more about a character issue. I'm concerned about you. Like is all about me. I am the focus of like. You are the focus of my love. They're not on the same scale. They're on two completely different scales. And when we confuse them, we confuse our personal interests and bias with our covenant commitment to do something.